I'll move to agenda item 2, the College of Forestry's Dean's Research Initiative.
There we go. Good morning, Chair Imus and members of the board, State Forest Authority. For the record, my name is Lena Tucker, Private Forest Division Chief. So while they're getting the slide deck going and prepared, it's just my pleasure to be able to introduce Jeff Huntington and Dr. Jim Rivers. And they are going to provide a summary and update of OSU's Dean's Research Initiative on the Oregon Marbled Morillette Project. I'm really pleased that they can reschedule their time and join us today. And I hope you'll find this very interesting. And I guess a bonus is that they've got some updated information over the past couple of months. So, again, thank you, gentlemen. I'm so glad you're able to join us.
And notwithstanding the fact that we do get some additional information by your coming here today, I don't think you were here earlier today, but we really apologize for the fact that you'd have to return and that we didn't get this.
There were intense conversations happening that day that were very important. We understood. So, and the dean sends his regrets for not being here today and is trying to schedule another time to come back and talk more about some of the collaboration that we see on the horizon and some of the interesting research things that are going on at the university. For the record, I'm Jeff Huntington. I'm the Director of Strategic Initiatives for the College of Forestry. I work for the dean of the college on large-scale projects and initiatives that we're undertaking and just help see them through on the execution. And I'm here today basically just to set the stage so that you can hear from Dr. Jim Rivers, who's our guy that's on point for the Morillette project. This is a Dean's Research Initiative, which has a special category for us because it really means that it's at a scale, both in terms of the length of time and the dollars being invested, that we pay a lot of special attention to this project and others like it that we undertake on occasion. And because of that, we also do a little bit of extra work to make sure that we've got some oversight on the project that you might be interested in knowing about. This first slide shows the members of our team, or at least the names of the members of our team. We've got some great slides for you today, and I'm going to get out of the way so that you can see them here. The science team, we have four university faculty members that are on the science team. And have a lot of experience in some different facets that are relevant to the project. In addition, on a Dean's Research Initiative, we look to establish a scientific advisory committee that is outside the university with expertise that the team that is running the project can check in on and do some planning and peer review along the way as the project's being implemented. And you can see who we have on this project that's also engaged. And then we have worked closely with a stakeholder advisory group that we put together at the very inception. This project was funded in the 2015 legislative session and is expected to go on for about a decade. So we have been checking in twice a year with this project advisory committee, partially to make sure that the trajectory of the project continues to be relevant, that the deliverables, as best we were able, are timely to ongoing needs and discussions around some of the policy issues that arise, and that we can adjust the trajectory of the project to continue to be relevant over time. And that is all in the context of this fitting into what we call the Institute for Working Forest Landscapes at the College of Forestry and Oregon State University. In 2014, we created a new research institute that was developed to that was created to develop adaptive forest management techniques that really focused on integrating social, ecological, and economic objectives at a landscape level. And the institute was founded on the premise that individuals and community livelihoods are intimately linked to the health and the productivity of surrounding landscapes, regardless of ownership boundaries, and that we need, as the university, to develop and test new active management models that bridge public and private forest lands in support of sustainable economic, biological, social conditions that are the signature characteristics of healthy working landscapes. So we have an oversight board, and the dean will talk to you a little bit more about that board, I think, when he comes back to visit. But we really focus with this oversight board on developing research projects that really focus in on four key areas: resilient ecosystems, intensively managed forests, healthy people and communities, and competitive and innovative products. And we see the linkages between those four corner points or foundational pieces to research that's really going to be delivered by the college that is not only providing credible science, but is highly relevant and hopefully very timely to some of the big discussions that are happening in the state. This project fits squarely in that category of projects for us, and it's important for us to make sure we're sharing along the way. So Jim is available to you anytime for any kind of consultation on it as over the next number of years. I'll turn it over to Jim now.
Chair Amison, State Forester Doherty, members of the board, thank you for the opportunity to share with you the work that we've been doing on the project. And as Jeff said, this is a long-term project that is really hitting its stride, I think it's fair to say. And the starting point for this work, as you all know, is the marbled murrelet. And this is a species of seabird that is really unique relative to other species of seabirds here in North America. It's found throughout the Pacific Ocean from the Aleutians all the way down to Central California. And of course, here in Oregon, as well as in Washington, California, this is a species listed under the Endangered Species Act. And in terms of how murrelets make their living, they are a seabird, so that means they get all of their food from the ocean. They're generalists in the sense that they eat different types of forage fish species, but also invertebrates. During the breeding season, forage fish are really critical for this species, however, though, because when they deliver food to their nestling, what they do is they bring in a whole fish at a time. We don't have any evidence that they use invertebrates, so that becomes important, as we'll see in a little bit. We don't have good data on how long murrelets live, but based on other members of the auk family in which they're found, we suspect that they may be living 15 to 20 years. So they're a long-lived species. And we know that they only lay one egg per nesting attempt. And what that means from a recovery standpoint is that population recruitment is very slow, and at most, a single pair will raise one chick a year if that nest survives. What makes murrelets unique, though, is that they're a seabird, and they spend a lot of time in the ocean, but they move inland to nest. And we have records here in Oregon of birds moving more than 40 miles inland. And what murrelets are doing, as best we understand, is trying to disperse across the landscape so they reduce the risk of predation to their nests. And so this is a shot taken from the Cape Perpetua area. Murrelets are moving into these sites. They're looking for large trees with large limbs on which they can place their nest. And it turns out murrelets don't build a nest as much as they create a nest scrape on a large horizontal limb with a lot of moss and substrate in which the female can lay her egg. So murrelets move into these areas, and finding their nest becomes a real challenge when you think about 40 miles of coastal forest to start looking for these birds. Why is this so important in terms of our coastal forest and their management? Well, it turns out that for recovering murrelets, it's really critical that we have nest data. Not only do we need to know how successful birds are, but we also need to understand the mortality agents that cause nests to fail. And having that information allows us to potentially mitigate or manage those mortality agents. Based on the Northwest Forest Plan, we have the potential for more than 6.5 million acres of nesting habitat for murrelets in the state. But prior to our study, there were only 29 active nests located in the state. And that's important because, again, if we're trying to understand how successful birds are on average and what sort of causes of failure are occurring to their nests, we really need to have a better sample of nests. And that's where our project comes in. The Oregon Marbled Murrelet Project is a long-term research initiative from the College of Forestry to better understand the species, better understand what it needs in terms of its nesting habitat in our coastal forests. We've set up this project to have three different study objectives at the current time. All of these are tied together with this same goal of better understanding terrestrial habitat use of murrelets. The first objective is what we call our landscape level modeling piece. And here we're looking at murrelets as well as what we think are their key nest predators. That's jays, ravens, and crows, which we collectively refer to as corvids. And what we've been able to do working with a couple of postdoctoral researchers in our research group, we've been able to amass data from Oregon, Washington, and California that are literally tens of thousands of surveys where birds have been surveyed for in inland sites. We also have been able to get the at-sea distribution data, which tells us where birds are, and those are the data that are used for understanding population change through time. And we can also get information about nest predators, and we can take all of those data sets together and combine them in a way to start asking broad-scale questions about murrelets. And the important thing to note about this component is it's our first component because it doesn't it doesn't require any field work for us. We can basically use information that's already available in the literature and in many cases in unpublished data sets. But at the current time, we have a couple of papers that are in progress. What we're able to do is look at things like merlet abundance and distribution, look at changes in habitat over time, as well as changes in climate and those different nest predators that we think are important based on previous studies, as well as looking at things like habitat loss and fragmentation in merlets. So this is an ongoing study. Joe Northrup was our postdoc. He moved on to a permanent position. And at the current time, Dr. Sophie Garcia-Harris has taken the lead from him. So this is an active part of what we're doing. The second component of our research is a pilot study to try and better understand how merlets select nesting sites. And what we know about birds in forests is that they typically use structure to try and determine where they're going to be nesting. So a merlet wouldn't be looking for a nest in a clear cut because they require large trees. And that sort of structural piece is easy to measure. It's something that we often think about. But for many species of birds, including seabirds, we also know that there is a piece to their habitat selection, which we refer to as social attraction, or in some cases, conspecific attraction. In short, other members of that species may give information about whether a nesting site is a good location to set up shop. So we've been piloting some work with this where we're working with a private robotics company in Corvallis. We've developed what you see here in the lower, on the left-hand side of the screen, a playback recording device, which allows us to broadcast merlet vocalizations and then record whether or not there are responses to those vocalizations. And to date, what we've been finding is that there does seem to be a role of social cues in terms of merlets moving into areas. We've surveyed sites that were previously considered unoccupied, and by playing some of the playback vocalizations, we've been able to document that birds are moving into these areas. This is not a key part of what we're doing, but what it allows us to do is better understand how these birds are functioning on the landscape, and in a sense, if we have areas that we do find that are unoccupied and we want to try and recruit merlets to those areas, this may be one way in which we can do that. Where we spend most of our time on this project, most of our resources, is looking at the intensive demographic monitoring piece where we want to quantify reproductive success. And we do this, as we'll see in a minute, by capturing birds on the ocean and then tracking them into their inland nest sites. And as I mentioned earlier, nest success and population recruitment really is one of the limiting factors in terms of data that we need to manage the species better. So that is kind of first and foremost what we get from this part of our project. But we get a lot more. We actually can leverage the data that we get from capturing and tagging birds. One thing that we're able to do is look at how these birds are using terrestrial habitats, and in particular, where they're selecting nest sites. Nest site selection occurs at several different levels in the landscape, on the scale of the stand, on the scale of the tree, and we can start looking at where nest sites are relative to where birds may not be nesting and start to understand better where these birds are, how far they may be nesting from the ocean, and associated factors that tie into that nest site selection piece. We also know that merlets are birds of two worlds. It's important to have a good marine system for them during the breeding season, as well as a terrestrial environment. And so we can actually look at the interactions of birds during the nesting season to see where they're nesting and where they're moving to in terms of these foraging areas, and whether or not there may be particularly important areas along the coast that we would refer to as a foraging hotspot that we can start piecing together the interactions between those two systems, which, as we'll see in a moment, is quite important. And then the last thing that we do with each bird that we capture, we're able to get individual level data about health parameters. We look at these birds very closely. We take morphological measurements. We take blood samples. All of this allows us to get a sense of how the birds are doing, what sort of prey items they're eating. And ultimately, we're able to take blood samples and bank those into a cooler that we can use down the road to look at population genetic pieces and start working with other researchers in other parts of their range to try and tell a full story. So that's kind of a high-level view of the project, and it kind of speaks to the three different components that we have. What I want to do now is shift gears a little bit and talk about that third piece and really talk about how we find nests, because that becomes a real challenge, not only for us on the ground, but also for getting high-quality data. I think it's safe to say that the merlet is probably the most difficult bird to work with, or maybe challenging bird is a better way to say that, of all the birds that we have here in Oregon. So to find nests in the forest, we don't actually start in the forest. We start on the ocean. And the reason for that is we want to have an unbiased sample of birds, and we don't want to start by assuming that birds are going to be in one particular habitat or another. So by going out in the ocean and tagging birds, we don't know whether a given bird is going to be going into a state forest or a private forest or a federal forest. So we leave out of Newport. We do this in the late spring, right prior to the breeding season, so late April and into May. And we leave Newport, we go out for the night, and we spend that night looking for birds on the water. The last couple of years, we've used the Pacific Storm. This is a great research vessel that has given us an opportunity to work on these birds. We refer to it as the mothership. It's where most of the action happens. Once we get out onto the water, we either go north or south, depending on the weather. And the first thing that we do once it gets dark is we offload a Zodiac. This Zodiac is 14 feet long, and we somehow sandwich three researchers into that Zodiac. And their job for the entire night is to look for murrelets in the nearshore zone. I've referred to these as the Navy SEALs of the ornithological world because they are out there in the nearshore environment, which in all seriousness is an incredibly risky place to be. They're literally putting their lives at risk by doing this. But they're the best in the world. These our researchers, our colleagues have more than five decades of experience capturing birds in the water, have caught thousands of birds, and they're really, really effective at capturing birds when they're there. So we sit on the mothership and we wait for those birds to come back. And sure enough, within half an hour or so after that boat leaves, they come back with a bird and we start processing it. The first thing we do is we look over that bird. We make sure it's a healthy bird that we can undertake these morphological measurements and consider tagging. If it's not healthy, we release it right away. What we've found is that very few birds are in that category. So almost all of the birds that we capture, we're able to take some measurements from. We attach a uniquely numbered aluminum band to the bird's leg. That allows us to follow up if that bird is captured or recovered at any point in time. We can know when it was captured and who captured it and where. We also, as I mentioned earlier, we take blood samples and all kinds of different measurements about the bird's health. And if the bird is of sufficient size, we then put on a small VHF tracking tag. This tracking tag has a small battery in it. It lasts about 90 days. Sometimes we get a little bit more than that if we're lucky. And this tracking tag gives off a constant pinging sound in the very high frequency range that the birds can't hear and we can't hear, but we can use receivers to dial into where that bird is. And each bird gets a uniquely different frequency on its with its particular tag. So we can monitor multiple birds at different times and know where those birds are. All of this takes place very rapidly. Our permit allows us to handle these birds for no more than an hour. And so we've been able to get this process down to about 35 minutes from the time we first captured that bird to the time that we release it. And believe it or not, this is the easy part of doing the tracking piece, because once we have the birds released with the tracking tags, we then have to monitor them within this very large marine environment. The first thing we do is we have a small army of field technicians who are at the ready, anywhere from 10 to 15 techs we have each summer. And what they do is they blanket the coast almost every morning from Pacific City to Florence, a 75-mile stretch of coast. And at each of our predetermined telemetry stations, they're listening for all of the birds that we have tagged to date. And they are taking information about where those birds are and where they're moving through time. As I said, we've got 90 days of a battery life on these tags, so we can see where the birds are moving from May to June and July, and sometimes even beyond that. What we're really listening for, though, is the signature movements of birds from the marine environment into the terrestrial environment. And so if we hear a bird that's on the water on Monday and it's missing on Tuesday, but it's back on Wednesday, it's missing on Thursday, that suggests that that bird is starting to move inland. And it turns out that murrelets are equal opportunity parents. Males and females share in the incubation duties, and they incubate for 24 hours at a time. So once we have that signature on-off pattern, we suspect that that bird that's tagged is probably nesting. And then we get up with our fixed-wing aircraft and we start looking for that bird in the coast range. And usually within a day or two of looking for that bird, we can narrow down that location to part of a stand. And at that point, the next step is for that ground crew who's been doing the marine telemetry to move into the forest and start looking for that bird and trying to narrow down where that potential nest tree is. Fortunately for us, the murrelets sit on that nest all day. They don't move from that nest site, so we have a fixed location where that beacon is basically giving off that signal. Turns out that's not always the easiest thing to do because murrelets nest high in trees, and as I mentioned earlier, they don't build a nest. So you don't, unless you're really, really lucky, you don't see the nest from the ground. So we do a lot of reconnaissance, listening for that tag. But as you can see from this picture, when you're in a stand that is a potential nest stand, there's lots of interference from signals. And if you've ever tried telemetry tracking, it's really hard to narrow down that signal. So we do the best we can. We get it down to one tree or perhaps two or three trees. And then the next step in this process is to go out with a group anywhere from 3 to 6 technicians in the pre-dawn hours. We get in locations where we can see the sky, and then we wait for the birds to come into that potential nest site. So imagine looking for a bird that's the size of a dove that flies very quietly. It doesn't call when it flies. You might hear its wing feathers. And it flies about 65 miles an hour, and it flies into this nest site under the cover of darkness. And then its partner leaves within about 10 or 15 seconds. So if you drop your pencil and you're not paying attention, you may actually miss that incubation exchange, and that's critical. So we have people on the ground watching for that exchange, and usually it takes us 3 or 4 days before we can finally narrow it down to that particular tree where the nest is. At that point, we have a canopy ecologist that we work closely with. He climbs an adjacent tree, puts up a Zoom video camera that runs 24/7, and we monitor that nest until it's finished. So we get information about parents coming in and incubating, feeding chicks, and then we also get information about what causes the nest to fail if it does fail. So that is a little bit of background on just how we do the field work. And I think it's safe to say that this is a challenging endeavor. And it's part of the reason why it hasn't been done is because it is such a complex research project, and there's so many different working parts. What I want to do now is share with you the results that we've had over the last couple of seasons. We've had 135 birds that we've been able to radio tag in 2017 and 2018, which was a big success for us because we weren't sure how successful we would be capturing birds in the open ocean conditions. Oregon's very different from some of the other areas where Merlet biologists have worked. And so in 2017, we tagged 61 birds, and we were excited about the prospects of nests, and we sat back and our technicians were listening intently for the movement of the birds in and out of the forest. We listened intently, and we listened, and we listened. And it turns out none of those 61 birds moved inland to nesting sites. And that was unprecedented because we haven't had a Merlet study where so many birds have been tagged and no nests have been found. And it turns out, as best we can explain, the ocean conditions in 2017 were very poor for reproduction. Off the central coast of Oregon, we had warm water temperatures, we had limited upwelling, we also had a lens of fresh water that came out of the Columbia River and moved down into central Oregon. And all of those things combined to make it a poor year for reproduction. And so what we think happened was the birds made a decision about not nesting because the food resources weren't good, but they didn't have those forage fish that they need to raise their young. What was equally important, or equally surprising, I should say, is the extent to which Merlets moved across the landscape. We documented individuals that we tagged in central Oregon that moved more than 350 miles to the north and to the south. So all the way up to Cape Flattery in Washington, all the way down to San Francisco Bay. So each one of these yellow points on this map indicates a day where we detected one of our tagged birds across the whole season. So you can see over that period in which we monitored birds, there was a huge movement of individuals. And that's really important because what I've shown here in this figure are the different zones in which the ATSI surveys are conducted. These ATSI surveys are conducted in a way to quantify population changes in birds, but due to budget constraints, they are not conducted in each survey zone in each year. So zones 1 and 3 are conducted in even years, zones 2 and 4 are conducted in odd years, and zones 5 are conducted every 4 years. So what that means is that we had birds in our zone 3 that ultimately moved into other zones and potentially were counted as birds that were resident in those areas. And of note, zone 5, we had birds that moved all the way down to California. Zone 5 in 2017 was surveyed, and there were 12 times as many birds detected in that area. Now, it's possible that there was a population increase, but it seems more likely that that was due to an influx of birds, some of which we actually have evidence that our tag birds went there. So this was very unprecedented, and it really gives us some information about movement of birds within a season that we didn't have prior to this. Now, fortunately, we continued this project last year, and I'm happy to report that we did find active nests. We located 8 over the course of the season, and although that may not seem like a lot from the 76 tagged birds that we had, it represents an increase of 28% in terms of the number of active nests for which we were able to determine fate here in Oregon. As you can see from this map, the nests were south of Newport. They were all found in the Siuslaw National Forests. 3 of those nests were successful and fledged an offspring. 5 of them were unsuccessful. And although it's difficult to draw conclusions from 8 nests, this really isn't enough to do any sort of statistical analysis. We are finding new things about murrelets that we didn't appreciate before this project, both here in Oregon as well as throughout their range. And one of the first surprises for us was that we had the first record of a red-tailed hawk that caused nest failure. What you see in this picture is a hawk. You can see the head here and this fluffy, out of focus, downy object is a murrelet that was about 3.5 weeks old. And the parents had been incubating this nest diligently. They were feeding this chick earlier in the day, and this red-tailed hawk came in and within about 15 seconds removed that chick. And so this speaks not only to what we have to learn about murrelet nest predators, it also points out that we actually didn't detect any corvids causing nest failure, that we thought that they would be the key nest predators, but that's not the case in this particular setting. Another first that we had in our study was the first record of a murrelet nest in a big leaf maple. There's one or perhaps two records from British Columbia, but none in the lower 48 states. And if you look in the lower right here, you see that there's a murrelet sitting on this nest. And if I didn't tell you it was in a big leaf maple and you were up on your murrelet biology 101, and if I said it was a large diameter horizontal limb with lots of moss, you'd say, well, that's exactly what murrelets are using, but you probably would have the image of a conifer tree and not a big leaf maple. So again, this is a small sample of nests, so who's to say if this is occurring more commonly, but again, we're finding out some new things about murrelets with just a small sample of nests. The other thing that we're finding out is that even in years where we have birds breeding, 2018, we also had birds that were moving large distances. So these two images, you've seen the one on the left already, but the one on the right indicates that the geographic breadth of where birds that were tagged in Central Oregon ultimately were detected through airplane flights later in the season. And the effort was different between the years, so take this with a grain of salt, except to say that geographic scope is very similar. And we don't know why that is. We don't know what it is about those birds that cause them to go north or south. We do know that murrelets don't breed until their third year. So it could be that these are pre-breeding individuals that wouldn't have been breeding anyways. It could be that some of these birds are wintering in Oregon and they may be moving into other parts of the range. Those are all hypotheses that remain to be tested at this point. But what I think we can say is that in terms of our first couple of years of this long-term study is that we are able to really start adding some important information to murrelets. We've been able to increase the number of active nests by 28%. We've got new information on the diversity of nest predators here in Oregon, as well as the different types of trees that these birds are using to place their nests. And I think it's also important to consider ocean conditions as being influential in nesting activity. And from the beginning of our project, we've known this. Our focus has been on understanding where birds are nesting and what their reproductive success is. But we really can't decouple that. Murrelets are birds of two worlds, and we have to consider the ocean and the ocean conditions as well, because we may have really good nesting habitat, but if we don't have good ocean conditions, we won't have reproduction in birds. And then the last piece, that within-season movement really gives some pause about how we conduct surveys at the current time. I think anyone who works with murrelets would love to see those surveys conducted in all survey zones in each year. That's just not possible at the current time due to funding limitations. And I'll end my presentation just by giving a couple of updates on where we plan to go in the future. In the short term, we're going to conclude that component 1 and 2 of our project, wrap up the spatial modeling and the social attraction studies. We're going to keep on in the midterm for that core piece of looking at reproductive success. We also get good information, as you have seen, about space use of birds. And we're also starting to add a piece where we're looking at ocean conditions to try and understand the influence of ocean conditions on occupancy inland as well as reproductive success. We can do that from the historical data that we've got as well as the data we're collecting. And there's a number of oceanographers that we're starting to tap into to better understand how we can do that best. And then as a long-term goal, what we'd really like to do in this project is understand how nesting activities are influenced by forest management. We're not there yet, but we're looking to build towards that, and ultimately that's what we hope to do with this project. So with that, I want to thank you again for your time and for the opportunity to update you in this project, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have on it.
Yes, Joe. Fascinating research. So that sounds exciting. The nests that you found, what was the distances from the ocean that you found those nests? What was the average or what was the farthest?
I think the closest was about 3 kilometers, and putting that into miles is less than 3/4 of a mile or so, and all the way out to about 30 kilometers. So I think the average would probably be somewhere 15 to 20 kilometers for these birds. So we're not pushing that 40 miles that we know. That's uncommon, but they're moving to sites that are fairly far inland.
Because they're carrying, they're foraging in the ocean, and they're bringing that fish to the, traveling along quite a distance.
That's right. Yeah. When they commute, either when they're incubating, they go once a day, but when they're feeding chicks, they can actually go multiple times a day, each individual. And part of what we're able to do with our video data is actually quantify that and understand how those visits may vary depending on how far nests are inland and how often birds come in. In fact, we've got some nests where the camera is in such a good position, we can actually get information on the prey items. So we know different species of fish, and we can even get estimates of how long they are. And what that allows us to do is start quantifying energetics of how much each fish may provide to that chick. And that's important because what we're finding as well is that nestlings that are fledging do so at different times. It's not just after a month the birds leave. There is variation in individual nests in terms of how long the chicks are in that setting. So we can start teasing those things apart with the data that we were collecting.
Another question. I mean, it's fascinating to me that you found one nesting in a big leaf maple. I mean, so that sounds like that was fairly surprising. Do murrelets in other areas nest in different types of settings? Cliffs or like another seabird in other parts of like Canada or Alaska?
Yes, they do. And there has been a cliff nest documented in Washington, but as you move north, you start finding more cliff nests. Kim Nelson, who's on our team, had a graduate student a few years back who was looking at basically doing similar work as us and finding that about half of the nests were cliff nests and half were tree nests. So we haven't found any cliff nests here in Oregon yet, but we do know that if there is a platform that's viable for them, and sometimes it comes in the form of something like a witch's broom, some sort of deformity on the tree, they can use that in trees that are younger as well.
Where the nest was on the big leaf maple, was there an alternate nest? Was there a large conifer there?
There were, and for me, this was one of those times where it's a good reminder of assumptions, because we had our technicians out there saying, we think that there's a bird that might be going into the big leaf maple, but there were a number of other birds in that same stand, and there were a number of potential nest trees that were much bigger and that were all conifers. And so we said, okay, well, keep an eye open, but keep looking. And eventually they said, we really think it's in here. And sure enough, it was. So I think part of that confusion was that we did have other birds. We know that murrelets can co-occur in stands. And so that is definitely a possibility that there was one bird nesting in one of those other trees, and that one pair selected this big leaf maple.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Brenda? Jim, great presentation. Thank you. You mentioned that red-tailed hawk killed one of the young, and there were four other nests that failed. Any assessment of what killed those or why they failed or any pattern on the landscape? I know it's a very small sample size, but
right.
Trying to understand.
Yeah, so in total, we had five nests that failed. One was we had a predation event during the nestling period. Another nest that failed during the nestling period, the parents appear to reduce their visits to that nest, and we don't really know why that is. Ultimately, the chick died on the nest, and we're still working through the video. We have something like 6,000 hours of video footage and a small army of people in a lab that only get out once they get through an hour. No, I'm just kidding. We have a lot of people working on it right now. And so what we've found so far is that there's regular visits to that nest, but we haven't gotten those last couple of weeks where we think the chick started to decline. That could have been something that happened to the parent. Parent could have had some issue, or it could have been something that's happening with the chick as well. In terms of the other three nests, two of them we weren't able to get a video camera on before they failed. So those were failing during the incubation period. And so we've been able to infer those nest fates as failing. We don't know why. And then the third nest that failed during the egg stage was one where the egg was viable as best we can tell, and then the parent stopped attending. We had one bird that came in and its mate was supposed to relieve it, and it didn't, and that mate came in about a day and a half later, and then it seemed to throw off the nest. It was within that 28-day period where the nest where the egg should have been viable. So it may have been something going on with the individual birds as well. So I think the big surprise for me, at least, was I've been thinking about corvids as causing nest failure. And at least on our 6 nests that we videotaped, we don't have evidence for that. Yes. Yeah, so in 2017, 61 tagged birds. I think we had somewhere around 74 birds that we captured. So we have constraints on our permit in terms of putting on tracking tags. The second year, 2018, 76 tagged birds out of something like 94 birds that we captured in total. We don't have a good handle on why some birds choose to breed and some don't. What we do know is that there is always a subset of birds that don't breed. And we've been challenged by this. There's no good predictor of a bird in the hand to say whether this bird is going to be breeding. And if it was, we would be able to target those birds and increase that breeding propensity, because ultimately our goal is to find those nests. And so we get good information on birds that don't nest. Other studies, especially recent studies in Washington, have also found low breeding propensity in the range of 15 to 20% of tagged birds. So we don't have a good handle, and I don't want to speculate too much. It could be on the individual level. It could be on marine resources. There's a number of hypotheses that I think need to be tested.
Are you able to get any age demographic data?
So that's another challenge for us. These birds, as I said, don't breed until 3 years of age, and we can't tell whether a bird is a 1 year old or 2 or 3 year old bird in the hand. We don't know if it's a 14 or 15 year old bird. The only chance we have at that with our birds is if it's been previously tagged, then we have a minimum age. And of the 150 odd birds we've captured over the last 2 years, we've only recaptured one individual bird. So in some areas, California, where there's lots of birds, you can recapture birds and start estimating population age classes, but we don't have that ability here at the current time.
Other questions? So what's the right interval for us to get updated on this? Is it annually? What would be, I think I heard Jeff offer you up for the next 10 years or so.
That's right.
Yeah. That would be fine. I think we usually get a good sense of what's going on by the winter. As I said, it takes a while to get through the video, and we usually have a fall all hands meeting where we go through kind of the what we've learned from the season. We start building that story of okay, how is this tying what we already know and what have we learned additionally. So I think that would be fine from my perspective if it works for you.
Really, really interesting. Really appreciate your being here.
And we would be happy to set that up after the next field season going into next winter, and we'll work with staff to do that. Given the season of the legislative session, everything, I'd be remiss if I didn't say that this is an example of the kind of work that Oregon State University does as part of its statewide public services budget, which supports agricultural experiment stations, the extension service, both agriculture and forestry, and then our forest research lab. So this is something that we had stakeholders come to us in the lead up to the 2015 session talking about what would be very relevant and important kind of research to tackle that would be long term, and we fed that into our statewide public services budget request, and this is an example of what we do every other year when we're talking to the legislature.
Great. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
And we do have a couple of folks who have signed up to appear on this topic. Seth Barnes and Megan Tuttle.
You ready?
Anytime.
Okay. Chair Emerson, members of the board, State Forester Doherty. For the record, my name is Seth Barnes, and I'm the
I work for the Oregon Forest and Industries Council. I am coming before you today to talk about the Marb Murillette. For the past 3 years, I've served, as you saw, as a representative of the forest landowning community on the Dean's Advisory Panel for the OSU Marb Murillette Research Project. I've been a big supporter of this research project since its inception, and with you, I continue to be impressed with the good work and valuable information that is unfolding as the project has continued. I assume you're impressed. I would hope you would be. This research is new, and as is the case with this species, getting real data is both costly and difficult. Obtaining information takes patience. As you've seen today, there are some very interesting pieces of information that are emerging, information that challenges much of what the experts thought they knew for decades. Well, that is the real takeaway in my estimation. But to this point, we now know enough to know that we don't know a whole lot about the species. That is to say, we need to continue to watch and learn as research continues to unfold a very interesting story about a very secretive species. One site does not define an ecosystem, just as 1 year does not make a trend. Good sound investments take some time to mature and bear fruit, and the same is true for sound investments in large-scale research projects like this one. Now, some would urge this board to make hasty and far-reaching decisions in terms of species and murrelets and others, and discourage a measured approach with an eye towards emerging science. In the very wise words of my grandmother, haste makes waste. The very best information we have clearly shows a population that is on the rise across Oregon and California, and a stable population across the entire range of the species. The only area showing declines in this species is up in Washington State, where the Puget Sound region, which is with its own challenges of land use planning issues, appears to be a factor. I would further remind this board that this species lives on the water, as strange as that is. The bird lives at sea. So those at-sea counts conducted by a consortium of state and federal agencies over almost 20 years is the very best data that we have. Furthermore, with an ever-increasing age class across a very broad swath of federal forests, one could make the case that hasty decisions have already been made prior to receiving new information. And perhaps it's time to take a different approach and learn from the past before we dive headlong into the future. I appreciate the thoughtful approach of Dr. Rivers and his team of researchers involved in this project at Oregon State University, and we in the industry look forward to continuing to learn more about the species as the research unfolds.
Chair Imason, State Forester Doherty, and Board of Forestry members, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Megan Tuttle, and I am the Western Environmental Affairs Manager for Weyerhaeuser Company. Weyerhaeuser owns 1.6 million acres in Oregon, where we have operated for over 100 years and have 1,000 employees. We appreciate that the Board of Forestry is interested in the OSU College of Forestry Dean's research initiatives on marbled murrelets in relation to the ongoing forest practices rule analysis for defining resource site protection rules. As noted in Seth's OFIC comments, research is critical to better understanding the importance of ocean conditions as well as the upland habitat needs of the murrelet. While supporting research is important, it is also critical that the Board of Forestry recognize the role of the United States Fish and Wildlife Service Federal Recovery Plan, what it plays in Oregon, and how those measures should influence future decisions by the Board of Forestry regarding the resource site protection rules. First, the vast majority of murrelet sites found in Oregon are associated with the Northwest Forest Plan's late successional reserve designations. LSRs are typically comprised of stands that are generally 80 years or older. Second, the Federal Murrelet Recovery Plan recognizes that virtually all remaining potential murrelet habitat in the Coast Range of Oregon is located on federal lands. The plan also recognizes that some potential habitat is likely located on the Elliott State Forest or the Tillamook State Forest in stands that range between the ages of 65 and 150 years old. Third, when the Murrelet Recovery Plan attempted to model predicted habitat, it found that only 3% of murrelet habitat would be found on private lands. The Recovery Plan modeling effort, as well as monitoring results associated with the Northwest Forest Plan, clearly demonstrate that the vast majority of actual and predicted murrelet habitat is located on state and federal public lands. Fourth, The federal recovery plan recognizes that species recovery is needed on a landscape level and concluded in Oregon that federal coastal ownership meets this landscape level need. The plan acknowledges that habitat and private forest lands in particular are not the limiting factor for murrelet recovery in Oregon, and on page 85 says that virtually all remaining potential habitat in the Coast Range is on federal lands. I think we saw that today when they talked about all of the sites were found in the Siusla National Forest, even though there are only 8 of them. Across the Murrelet Range, the plan also says that approximately 89% of the estimated marbled murrelet habitat is on Bureau of Land Management and Forest Service lands within areas designated for protection. In closing, the Board of Forestry should take this information into consideration when it decides if it should develop murrelet resource site protection rules. Put simply, are murrelet resource site protection rules necessary on private lands? And if they are, the Board of Forestry should be guided by a simple fact. The vast majority of murrelet sites are located in stands that are greater than 80 years of age and typically are located within 30 miles of the Oregon coast. Thank you.
So we'll break now until 11 a.m.